Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, July 26th, 2015. This is episode 1206. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Intel. Small business owners can't afford to choose between A or B. If both help your business, you want A and B. With Intel-powered 2-in-1s, you get performance and mobility. Power and freedom. That's the power of and. Experience it at smallbusiness.intel.com. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Get $25 off the Ring Video Doorbell when you go to ring.com/tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones, smartwatches, all of that jazz. 888 Ask Leo, that's my number, 888-827-5536. Give us a call. Let's get on the show. Let's. You're my partner in this show. Can't do it without you. Let's talk high tech. 888-827-5536. You'll be talking to Kim Schaffer. She's our phone ranger for the day. And she'll be getting you ready for your appearance on the national stage. You too can join the giant number of candidates for the president of the United States on the national stage. Fascinating email just come out in the courts from Google. So I should give you some information to get you set up for what this email says. Turns out the Motion Picture Association of America, in an effort to find and destroy pirates, decided that at some point Google was a piracy tool. The search engine, because you could use the Google to find pirated stuff. So they decided to go after Google, but instead of kind of going after it head on, they decided to take a little bit of a back route. First thing they did was they went to the Attorney General of the state of Mississippi, Jim Hood. They didn't go to him directly. No, the Motion Picture Association of America is much more cagey than that. They found a former Mississippi Attorney General, and they said, would you talk to Jim and have Jim go after Google? Apparently, Jim Hood, the Attorney General of Mississippi, decided that the state of Mississippi should investigate Google for finding stuff, pirated stuff online. A court has already ruled that Hood acted in bad faith. He was trying to deprive Google of its First Amendment rights. See, government shall not abridge the rights to speak freely. So that's right there in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution there. So Google's been saying now, well, let's find out more about this. Let's learn more. By the way, you know how they find out about Jim Hood? A lot of the MPAA correspondence was on the Sony hard drives that were hacked and then released, the Sony Pictures Entertainment. So when that information was released, Google looked at it and said, oh, whoa, wait a minute. So now they're continuing to get information. And Thursday, Google revealed an email between the Motion Picture Association of America and two attorneys in the Mississippi Attorney General's office discussing the big plan to hurt Google. This is Mike Masnick writing at Tech Dirt. He's great. TechDirt.com. Beyond influencing other attorneys general using misleading fake setups of searches for, quote, bad material, and paying for fake anti-Google research, the lawyers from Hood's office flat out admit they're expecting the MPAA and the major studios to have their tame media arms run a propaganda campaign of bogus anti-Google stories. So they sent a letter saying, you know, we're supporting what you're up to here, and here's what we're going to do to help. This is a direct quote from the email. Media. We want to make sure the media is at the NAAG meeting. The N-A-A-G meeting. Don't know what that is. But anyway. We propose working with the Motion Picture Association of America, Comcast, and News Corp to see about working with a PR firm to create an attack on Google and others who are resisting Attorney General's efforts to address online piracy. In other words, to stick it to Google. This PR firm can be funded through a nonprofit dedicated to intellectual property issues. This is the email. This is how stuff gets done behind closed doors. The live buys, quote, live buys should be available for the media to see. These live buys of purported pirated material. Followed by a segment the next day on the Today Show. This is Comcast Universal owns the Today Show, don't they? We're going to go to Comcast. Hey, could you help us out? Help a buddy out here. Why don't we do a segment on the Today Show about how Google's helping pirates? Okay. After the Today Show segment, you want to have a large investor of Google come forward and say that Google needs to change its behavior and demand reform. This is all orchestrated behind the scenes. This is what you imagine is going on, but you think, no, that couldn't possibly be. Next, this is still the email. You want News Corp to develop and place an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. News Corp owns the Wall Street Journal. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. To place an editorial in the Wall Street Journal emphasizing that Google's stock will lose value in the face of a sustained attack by attorneys general and noting some of the possible causes of action we've developed. In other words, an editorial in an ostensibly independent newspaper saying, yeah, this is going to hurt Google and the stock's going to plummet, which of course would cause the stock, because it's the Wall Street Journal, to plummet. Incredible. And I wonder if it's stock manipulation, isn't it? And that would be a federal offense. The plan goes on. This is more of the email. Following the media blitz, the orchestrated media blitz, you'll want Bill and Rick to work with the PR firm to identify a lawyer specializing in SEC matters to work with a stockholder. The lawyer should be able to identify the appropriate regulatory filing to be made against Google. Now, if I were the FCC, I'd be a little miffed by that. Let's see what happens. These are documents now revealed by this on, and Google's just miffed, as they should be. What goes on behind closed doors, huh? Fiat is doing a recall. Did you see the Jeep hack last week? The Wired magazine reporter who was driving along in a Jeep and hackers who were demonstrating how easy it was had hacked into the Jeep via the Sprint network. Turns out a lot of these vehicles are online all the time using 3G, but the security's not so good. So the hackers took control of the Jeep Cherokee via the entertainment system that was connected to the internet. Then they did all sorts of things. They changed the screen to be a picture of them. They turned off the brakes. Now, fortunately, this was on a test track, and the reporter who was doing this knew this was going to happen. So Fiat, at first shaking their heads, now say, you know, I think we're going to recall 1.4 million cars and fix that flaw. 1.4 million cars. Fiat Chrysler did say, exploiting the flaw, quote, required unique and extensive technical knowledge. Prolonged physical access to a subject vehicle, I might contest that one, and extended periods of time to write code. Yeah, it's a lot of work. Somebody'd have to really write some code. They did point out that doing that is criminal. Yeah. I don't think hackers care too much. So if you have a Jeep, well, if you have a Fiat or a Chrysler or a Jeep, I guess you should check and see if your car is affected by the recall. And if it is, you should probably do it. We've talked before about how insecure car systems are, but that one was a stunner. That was just stunning. 8888 Ask Leo. I'll talk a little more as we continue during the show. We're getting ready for Windows 10. Wednesday it comes out. Are you ready? Are you going to do it? Free upgrade if you have Windows 7 or Windows 8. You probably already got that little flag in your system tray saying, hey, hey, you want Windows 10? Come on, come on, come on. Hey, hey. We'll talk a little bit about what to do, why you might want Windows 10, why you might not. And I'll answer your code, your questions, your coded questions as well. 8888-ASK-LEO. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, your calls next. National Association of Attorneys General. That's what NAG is. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, grooving. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the fun number. Kim Schaffer is here with us today answering the phones. Good morgen, Kim Schaffer.
Good morgen to you, too.
Good morgen. Good morgen. Have you lined up some wonderful calls for us for the show today? Who should I start with?
Well, Chris in Florida wants to register some domains in other countries, and he needs information on how to do that.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of fun. There's some interesting names. You could get LY is Libya. Dot L-Y.
Okay.
So I used to have Geekly, Geek.ly.
That's cool.
Yeah. Stuff like that. Chris, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Leo. Thanks so much for taking my call. I appreciate
it. My pleasure.
So we're starting a business down in Brazil. And when I'm down there, they have a .com.br.
Right.
So when you sign on to Google or email or whatever, you get this interior Brazil website. And I'm trying to repeat that with a website we're going to start down there.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. But I don't know where to go to register. I use Network Solutions here in the States, but I'm seeing so many different things that don't really look.
Generally speaking, if you want a domain name that belongs to a country, it's a good idea to check the domain registry in that country. So here's how it works. There's a non-governmental organization called ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and they approve registries. They also approve country codes and all of that. It originally did start in the U.S. In fact, it was run by one guy, John Postel, out of USC for many years, but then the Internet got big. And so now I imagine there's a building somewhere with thousands of functionaries doing all of this. In order to get in the big internet phone book, and that's what you want to be, you have to go to domain registrar, and you want one that'll do .br. So there's a couple of ways to do it. One is to just, as I just did, Google search .br or Brazil domain registry, and you'll see a number of them some in the U.S., but some in Brazil. I see AmericaRegistry.com will do it. So in other words, you don't have to go to your registrar. Any registrar will do, as long as they will register the extension that you want. So AmericaRegistry.com will get you .com.br.
And then you own that name?
And you own it. Just like VeriSign or Dotster or Hover or GoDaddy or any of the other. They're all the same. They're all approved by and only use a registrar approved by ICANN. But it'll say that.
Yeah, you had mentioned Hover before, and I tried them, but they didn't do the .com.
Yeah, not everybody does everything. .ly, for instance, is only done by the Libyan government. So you actually have to go to the Libyan So these are all called NICs, N-I-C, Network Information Center. You go to the Libyan NIC, and they can give you .ly. Sometimes, like .tv, Tuvalu is a small island nation in the Pacific that's apparently sinking. But they have one of the most lucrative domain names, .tv. But you can get that from Hover or others because they allow resellers. You know, they set up others for resellers. So if you want .com.br, easiest thing to do for any domain name is to just Google and then at .com.br domain registry. And I found this one, America Registry, which I would bet is in Brazil, I would guess. Now, not cheap. .br or br.com, but not, that, who would want that? That's confusing. How about com.br? $135 a year.
Wow.
You can also get .tv.br if you want, or .net.br. Yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Here's one little fly in the ointment. They say here a Brazilian tax ID will need to be provided as a proof of oh, good. So this is sometimes the case. In some countries, they don't want you to get a country code domain unless you're in that country.
Yeah, they want you to have a CPF.
Yeah, you have a CPF, you're good.
Yes, yeah, so it should be good there. Yeah. Hey, how about an inexpensive tablet to give away to some of the less fortunate down there?
What a nice idea. Yeah, you can get really inexpensive. You know, they sell them at gas stations and stuff, 40 and 50 bucks. Not sure that's a good idea. Do you want I presume you want Android. I'm not sure that the $40 or $50 tablet is a great idea, but you can get decent. Here's the thing. The really cheap tablets, they don't provide Google services, which in my opinion, makes them less than useful. They didn't want to pay Google to make it a official Googly Android. See, Android's free if you don't care about having the Play Store or Google Maps or any of the Google features. It's free. It's open source. So the really cheap tablets, they don't pay a penny for the open source operating system. But the user gets kind of less than a full tablet. So I would look at a tablet that has Google Play services on it, including this Google Store, because then you have then you can add apps and stuff like that.
Right.
I like the Nexus 7. Google's discontinued it, but I think they might still be selling it. That's a little more expensive, though. You were probably thinking something on around $100 at most.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I would. I will have to look because Pantech, Pantech, is one of the companies that's fairly decent that makes really inexpensive tablets. But at $100, I don't know if you're going to get. You're going to get the Google services. The Nexus 7, which is full Google, is $150 on Amazon right now, but they're running out of them fast. Because that's Google stopped making them. That's the one I would look at. The Pantech Element, $109. They have even less, 55. I see one for $56. But the question is, does this have the Google Play Store on it?
Google Play services.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, sure. It's not the end of the world if it doesn't, but... It may indeed be that the kids you're going to hand these out to in Brazil don't care, right? If they can get online, they're probably happy.
If they can get on the internet, they'd be happy.
That's right. That'd probably be sufficient. Yeah. Pantech Element looks pretty good actually for $100. That's probably in your price range. 8888 Ask Leo, the number. Mark, I think we have time for Mark in Los Angeles. You're next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Great to talk to you, Leo. I've been a fan for a long time. Saw you, lucky enough to see you at the original Screensavers show. San Francisco. Hope to get a Petaluma to see the new Screensavers someday. But just had a question with encryption of my hard drive. You know, on Windows 7, I didn't really have any trouble encrypting. I was able to find it pretty easily in there. But for Windows 8.1, it does say on Google searches that it's encrypted and enabled by default. But when I try to, find it according to the directions online, I don't see anything about encryption on either one of my laptops, my Lenovo laptop or my MSI laptop. Something called Instant Go enabled, and I'm not sure if my laptop supports Instant Go. So,
yeah, you want to use Bootlocker, but Bootlocker is apparently not on all versions of Windows. Which version do you have? You need the Pro or the Enterprise version of Windows 8?
Oh, I have the Home.
Yeah, so you're going to have to use a third-party solution. We're going to take a break. I'll come back and explain what's going on there. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hey, we've got a new advertiser on the Tech Guy podcast. You might have heard of him. Little company called Intel. Oh, love Intel. We do it all with Intel, Mac and PC. With Intel and their new, for small business owners, there is no room for compromise. If your business is running on a computer, you don't want to choose. You can't choose. You can't afford to choose between A or B. If both are going to help your business, you want A and B. It's the power of and, my friends. It's not hard work or innovation that leads to success. It's hard work and innovation, versatility and strength. The power of and in Intel's powered 2-in-1s. You don't have to choose between a laptop or a tablet. It's a laptop and a tablet. You get performance and freedom. And make sure it's powered by Intel's latest family of core processors. you will impress your clients and your colleagues at the touch of a tablet. You'll be able to handle robust programs on the go, and you can do it right. And you can do it right now. That's a better way to work. That's the power of and. Find out more at smallbusiness.intel.com. I'm a big fan of these two-in-ones. You get laptop performance and power, but the mobility, the attractiveness, the lightweight of tablets. Maximum versatility. And nowadays, thanks to Intel, incredible battery life. Peak performance for business and great built-in graphics. Make sure you look for the fifth generation. Can you believe they're up to the fifth generation Intel Core processors? They run business applications up to 2.5 times faster than those old, than that old, probably your old 4-year-old laptop. The battery life now of these fifth gen Intel Core processors, up to 2.6 times longer than that 4-year-old laptop. 8.7 hours on average. The Intel Core M processor, have that in my MacBook. Love that. It gives you a razor-thin tablet, an ultra-fast laptop, and a single mobile device. The Intel Core M processor, based 2-in-1, provides the optimal combination of business-class performance and battery life. And don't forget Intel's wireless display technology. Both 5th-gen Core and Core M will wirelessly stream all the things you need, presentations, videos, websites, and more, live from your PC to your display. Intel's on the Twitter, too, at Intel Small Biz. Intel Smallbiz. Experience the power of and. Visit smallbusiness.intel.com and find out how Intel-powered 2-in-1s can improve your small business. That's smallbusiness.intel.com. And don't forget to follow them on Twitter at Intel Smallbiz. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Thank you, Intel. Oh, this is interesting. So maybe BitLocker is turned on some versions. Some mobile devices and those clones, blah, 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 blah. Thank you for that link. Windows 8.1 new device encryption treats your x86-based Windows tablet locked away. But your hardware has to support it. So this is kind of like the mobile operating systems, iOS particularly, are encrypted by default. So Ars Technica article says computers with the necessary hardware. That probably means a TPM chip, I would guess. Let's put a link to this article in the show notes. Yeah, you need secure boot, UEFI, and you need TPM. And you need TPM 2.0. Oh, well, that sucks. So most systems won't actually do this. Nice. And you can't, let's see. Oh, wow. So you also need connected standby. This is not something that's probably likely on most systems. So you're probably going to want to use something like TrueCrypt, I would think. We're talking about full disk encryption. And of late, it's the kind of thing people have started to expect on mobile devices. All iOS devices, all Apple iPhones and iPads, for instance, are encrypted when you get it. And you unencrypt or unlock it by entering the passcode in. And the good news on that is if somebody steals your iPhone, there's no way they can get to the data on it because it's encrypted. Android devices allow this as an option. Some newer Android devices like the Google Nexus 6 turn it on by default. But generally on Android, it's not turned on. Windows does support what you were just talking about. And actually, I thank the chat room for sending me a link describing this. But the bad news is this default automatic encryption in Windows 8.1 requires hardware support that few machines can satisfy. So that's probably what you saw, Mark. You saw that the capability was there, but your machine doesn't have the hardware it needs. So there's three things. You have to support secure boot, UEFI. Almost all Windows machines now do, new Windows machines. Okay. You need hardware on that machine called a trusted platform module. And again, most laptops do have TPM, but they have TPM 1.2. Hmm. And you need TPM 2.0. So you can look at the specs of your laptop to see if you have that. And finally, you need Windows support for Windows Connected Standby feature. which is that thing that wakes up while you're sleep, while the machine is sleeping, to get email and calendar events and stuff like that. And that is also, for some reason, I'm not sure why, required for Windows encryption to be on by default on Windows 8.1. So you're not going to, and you're using Home, which means you can't use what I recommend most people use, which is the built-in window full disk encryption called BitLocker. That requires Pro.
Yeah, well, actually, one of my laptops does have Pro. I misspoke. One has Pro, one has Home, and even on the Pro one, I can't seem to find that the BitLocker. I don't know what's going on, but so yeah, maybe I just need to look into a third party, like you were saying, like TrueCrypt. Or...
TrueCrypt is great. Unfortunately, TrueCrypt is free and it's open source, but unfortunately, the guys who make TrueCrypt about a year ago threw in the towel in kind of an abrupt fashion, and they even said, "Do not use TrueCrypt; it's not secure." Well, after that, there was a program to audit TrueCrypt. Some encryptologists, including Matthew Green at Johns Hopkins, had raised money via crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, to audit it, which is to go through to an independent third party to go through the source code and make sure there's no back doors, that it's that's written properly, that the encryption really is real. And they gave it thumbs up. They said there's a few weird things, but it's thumbs up. So if you can get the old version of TrueCrypt, you're okay. No guarantees on whether it'll work with Windows 10. We don't know yet. But Windows 8 should work fine. And you can't get it from the TrueCrypt.org site anymore, because when they threw in the towel, they posted a final version that disabled TrueCrypt, which was really mean.
Okay.
Really mean. So for your machine that has Pro, you have to go in the policy editor. gpedit.msc. And then you can turn it on. With a PIN. Now, be very careful when you turn on BitLocker, because you will want to save. BitLocker is something, it's something that uses certificates for the encryption.
Okay.
And you need to save that certificate, because if you lose it, you're out of luck.
Oh.
you can't unlock it. So
okay.
Take that certificate, put it somewhere safe, and somewhere other than that machine. So I do believe that BitLocker is a great choice still, if you can get the older version. There are people who have put it out, and there are what we call forks, people who took the original source code and are updating it. But I don't know, none of the forks have been audited, and I don't know yet if any of them are reliable and robust. So we do know TrueCrypt works. So I would go with that, and just if you Google TrueCrypt, you'll find legit versions of the last good version.
And I know you've talked about this many times about with the whole SSD drives, how it's once you start using it, it's too late to encrypt. So at this point, I'm wondering if there's any point.
It's not that it's too late, because encryption will still hide most of your stuff. The problem is there's a little bit of information leakage on solid state drives, because you can't write to sectors. The wear leveling prevents you from addressing specific sectors. So there may be data that's encrypted, but it's possible that some of your data doesn't get encrypted or kind of lies in slack space without encryption. But I wouldn't worry about that. Turn on encryption. Better to have that than not.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yeah, this is kind of a complicated subject, but now with everybody so concerned about privacy and security, I think it's a good one. And it's isn't it telling that Apple turns it on by default? And that I think more and more phones are going to do that, more and more tablets as well. My friend Steve Gibson makes a version of the last good version of TrueCrypt. He's our security guru. You hear me refer to him all the time. Available on his site, grc.com. So if you Google Steve Gibson TrueCrypt, he actually has a good write-up on why it's safe to trust TrueCrypt still, and you'd be all right. There are other choices. We'll put links in the chat room to some of the other choices, like VeraCrypt, which looks pretty good. It's based on TrueCrypt, but it hasn't been validated, and that makes me a little bit nervous still. 8888 Ask Leo. People are pointing out that Apple puts hardware to make the encryption fast, or decryption fast, and that's true on their iPhones. And most Android phones don't. I have a Nexus 6, and there was, when it first came out, Google turned on encryption on this. It is encrypted when it comes to you, the Google phone, but it's slow as a result because there's no hardware support for the encryption and decryption. Moving on to another Mark in Grand Rapids, Michigan, GR. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Leo. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you. Love the show. I've been watching you since you were on with Kate.
Thank you.
Hey, I have an iMac. It's a 20-inch early 08 iMac. The hard drive died. I had a backup, by the way.
Okay.
And I replaced it. But the new hard drive, it's a Western Digital, same model as I had in it, but the new hard drive does not have the cable for the hard drive temperature sensor.
Oh.
So now when I boot up, the fan blows full speed all the time.
Oh, because you can't attach it to the motherboard so that the motherboard knows whether you're hot and the operating system decides whether to turn the fan on or not.
Exactly. Hmm. I couldn't find that and I started looking around. I couldn't find a hard drive that had that sensor that fit this Mac. So I just left that hard drive in, and it's working great. But
that's annoying, though, isn't it?
It is. But do you think there's any chance that there's a utility out there, some sort of application that will allow me to control the fan just through software alone?
I didn't know that you could. This is news to me that you could connect the temperature sensor up to the hard drive, which is a great idea.
Yeah.
It looks like even if it didn't come with that wire, there may be there may be pins on the connector that you can access.
Could be the wire on the original hard drive came out of it. Like a port on the hard drive.
Yeah.
So it wasn't connected to the pins back around by the SATA connector.
Yeah, and by the way, your hard drive's not going to overheat.
I know.
But what is annoying is that the fans are going on and on and on.
Yeah, you can't turn them down. I haven't found anything out there yet that allows me to control that through the software. And probably, whatever the Apple BIOS is not going to allow that to happen anyway.
Actually, I think there is a program. And the SMC fan control, I will put a link in the show notes. Somebody in the chat room just passed along. We'll see if it works. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. SMC fan control. Control Intel Mac fans to make them run cooler. And that's interesting. Have you used SMC fan control? The person who recommended it? It comes from eidac.de. Well, it's made in Germany. Germans make good stuff. Do not get it from softpedia or download.com. Get it from the original author. So we'll put a link to this on eidac, eidac.de. SMC fan control. Reduced energy usage support for Yosemite dark mode. Looks like they're keeping it up to date. Neat. Neat, neat, neat. So there you go. And it will, in fact, let you turn down the fans, right? Nice. And Otherworld Computing apparently sells the cable for the inline digital thermal sensor. Man, you guys in the chat room are good. So we love Otherworld Computing, maxsales.com, and they sell an inline thermal sensor, which I presume connects to the motherboard. This is why I always buy upgrades from MacSales.com. Inline digital thermal sensor. Huh. So this is exactly the issue, right? You got the excessive fan noise because you're using a third-party hard drive. And the Apple Diagnostics will see this. Let's see how much it is. Look at this. Around $40. Actually, that's for iMacs. Neato. So you could use the SMC fan controller to turn the fans down, or you could actually buy a special cable that will do that. I'm with you on that, Jason E. I've been very disappointed with the LG G4 and S6. A lot of hesitation, slowdowns. And the Nexus 6, because it's pure lollipop, I would guess, is fine. 8888-ASK. Leo. So we'll put a couple of links in the show notes. Thanks to the chat room, we found a company that sells a hard drive connector for Macintosh computers that will connect to the new third-party drive and still give you that temperature sensor and, of course, software that will let you turn down the fans. Do it at your own peril because you don't want to overheat your system. Gordon, Long Island, New York. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Gordon.
Hello, Leo. How are you today, my friend?
I am well, my friend. How are you?
Very good. I'm a long-time geek, but first-time caller.
Well, welcome.
With all this Windows talk this week, it's been a long time since I made a recovery disk, and you were talking yesterday on the program about doing it to a flash drive.
Yes.
How can I find out, first of all, how much disk space I would need on the flash drive? Number two, can I do it on a flash drive that's has other data on it already, or do I need a virgin flash drive just for the recovery disk? And three, what is the basic process?
Unlike the real world, you can actually make a flash drive, any flash drive, virgin, and it will be made virgin in the process. It will wipe everything that's on there. So don't put it. Don't use anything. Don't use a drive that you need whatever's on it. It's going to erase it. It will tell you in the beginning of the process how much space it needs. Typically, it's 8 gigabytes, but it may depend on your system. You may have a larger backup partition, a restore partition, because that's what it backs up. So, and the process is very simple. If you go in Windows 8, if you just hit the menu key and start typing recovery, you'll see the recovery control panel. It's it'll allow you to, you can see make recovery. This is nice because until Windows 8, you have Windows 8?
8.1.
Yeah, perfect. Until Windows 8, you relied on the manufacturer. And often what they do when you first turn on the machine is say, okay, now time to make your DVDs. And if you didn't do it, that could just go away.
Right.
But this is Microsoft smart. Everybody should have a clean boot disk for your operating system, whatever it might be, so that you can, if you know the hard drive dies or you just have you make a mess of it, you can start over. So it's very simple. Go to the recovery control panel, and I'm not sure which control panel it's in, but if you just hit Windows key recovery and type recovery, you'll get there. And then I start with an 8 gig. It won't let you do it if the thumb drive isn't big enough, and it'll tell you how big it needs to be.
And it'll give you a second chance to do it. Then yeah. If your first,
you know what? I have a hundred thumb drives. None of them say how big they are. So I don't know if you watched yesterday. I was putting in drive after drive till I found one that fit.
I was watching that. Yeah. That's what prompted my phone call.
I was going, thumb drives have gotten so cheap, but, I have, unfortunately, a proliferation of 1 and 2 gigabyte thumb drives, which I think are not going to be big enough. I think the one I ended up using was 8.
Well, I have mine all on lanyards, and they're tied together
yes.
like one big ponytail, but
yes.
you're right. I'm not sure what's on any of them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it wouldn't be a bad idea for people to go out and get a couple of 32 or even 64 gig thumb drives. These are just so horrendously useful. I just made up a word.
And so cheap today,
And they're cheap. Next time you're at Fry's or wherever, just, say, hey, I'll pick it. They should have them in a bin in the front, like as you're checking out. Don't forget to take home some thumb drives.
We have a place here in New York called Micro Center, and
yes.
they have tons of them over there. And
yes.
frequently they use them as promos and giveaways.
Yeah, but those are the little ones, and that's why I have so many of those.
Right.
I have somebody brought me a Disneyland monorail thumb drive. I love it, but I was very disappointed. It's only 2 gigabytes. I can't do anything much with it.
Maybe next you go to Yale flash drive.
I remember Woz coming in to the old TV show, so this would have been more than 10 years ago, with a thumb drive around his neck, and he was so proud of himself. He said, this is 8 gigabytes, and nobody had heard of an 8 gigabyte thumb drive at the time. He said, this has everything on it. I have my life is on my thumb drive, and it's around my neck.
Wow.
And I thought, man, that's the Woz, man. He's cool. Now we all have him.
Well, just as an aside, before I get to my next quick question for you, the first time I got a computer with a 10-megabyte hard drive on it, I was told that will take everything I'll ever need as long as I own that computer.
Ever need more than 10 megabytes? That should
right.
be plenty.
And now the flash drives are being given away for less than that, with more storage on it.
I have to find an old air check because I remember several times predicting that pretty soon thumb drives will come in cereal boxes. And I bet they do. I don't know. I bet they do. Captain Crunch, you get a gigabyte thumb drive, everything you need on it.
Who knows?
What's question two?
Quick question on LastPass. I don't know whether I've been infected by malware on it or anything. I'm a little bit concerned. Every time I try to open up my LastPass anymore, I get a warning about an unresponsive script. If I hit the continue button, it does nothing except keep me in the stall mode.
It's damaged. So LastPass, like a lot of things, uses JavaScript for your local scripting.
Right.
And it's just damaged. I would uninstall it, remove the extension if you've installed an extension, or just download the newest version and reinstall. That shouldn't happen.
I have no problem logging into it without losing my data.
No, and the beauty part is one of the things I like and one of the risks of LastPass is it does store your passwords encrypted, but it stores them in the cloud at the LastPass servers. That's so you can use LastPass on every device and you always have your access to your passwords. So you don't have to worry, in other words, about losing your passwords.
Well, it's been very good so far, but I was just a little bit concerned about malware having caused this problem.
Yeah, no, it's not unusual. JavaScript is easily corrupted. In fact, I'm looking at a LastPass page, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Unresponsive script, slow LastPass loading. And I think the trick to this... Now, I have to say, LastPass was a little bit slow. You remember when they got hacked and they asked everybody to redo their passwords?
Right.
As a precaution, not because there was any concern, really, but just as being extra careful.
And I've done that, by the way.
And the other thing they told people to do is turn up the number of iterations of the hash iterations, and people use very large numbers for that. Well, that can make your LastPass unresponsive too. A, their servers are slow because everybody's getting new passwords, and B, you on your side, did you turn up your iterations on LastPass when we told you to do that? That can slow it down.
No, I haven't done anything along that line. Okay. I simply just put in a new password.
Yeah, I would just remove it and reinstall it. It's probably
the only thing that makes this work now is I hit the stop script button.
Yeah, and does LastPass continue to work after that?
And then it works fine.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, you would have thought debug script or continue would have been more helpful, but
stop the script that means something that's unimportant is kefluggered. You know, the way it draws the screen or something.
I think you just made up another word, too, by the way.
Kerfluggered. I'm good on that, yep.
Very good.
As I get older, more and more strange words emerge. I don't understand it.
Hey, that's why I enjoy listening and watching.
You never know what I might say. Mark, Gordon, it's great to talk to you. That's my middle name. I should remember. It's great to talk to you.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Leo. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work. We love your program.
Thank you. Keep listening. I really appreciate it. So we'll talk a little bit about password management, about LastPass, why I recommend it, and I feel safe enough to put all of my stuff in it when we come back after the break. News at the top of the hour, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Hang in there. What am I going to do with Windows 10? Let's change boot mode settings back to secure. You know why? Because I couldn't access the hard drive to update it with legacy on. Scanning or repairing drive, why? Why? Why, Windows? Why? Now, I'm back to Windows 10. But this is an old version. And then when I do the... when I do the recovery control panel, I created a recovery drive, but now I want to restore. Maybe I'll have to search for restore. Set up OneDrive. No. Ba-ba-dum. Reset this PC. I do. I want to reset it. Go back to Windows 8.1. Now watch this one. That's what I want to do. We're sorry, but you can't go back. The files we need to take you back to a previous version were removed. I didn't do that. Oh, man. How about resetting this PC? Restore factory settings. All right, that's what I want to do. Yeah, because I want to get the official Windows 10. Remove files and clean the drive. Okay, good. Maybe this will be fine. There was a problem resetting your PC. Cancel. That's it. I think I've screwed up my PC. Okay, choose an option. Use a device. I have a Windows Recovery CD, but it won't use it. Reset your PC or seat. Advanced options. Should I do the system image recovery? Startup repair? What should I do? No, I can't install the RTM Zendrome because I don't... They turned off the authentication. Yes. That's right, Lawn Dog. Microsoft turned off the authentication. I blew it by installing an older ISO, hoping that I would be able to run the updates, but the authentication server's been turned off. So what should I do? Install OS X. Format? If I format it, will that be good? System image repair? System image recovery, I mean? Well, this was a Windows 8 machine. I created the refresh media. Windows cannot find a system image on this computer. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. We're talking computers, we're talking the internet, we're talking home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, Windows 10, and all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the number. 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. You can also call us via Skype if you're outside that area. The website is techguylabs.com, and that's where we put links, information, more additional stuff gleaned from the chat room. All of that goes to the website, techguylabs.com. We break it up to day by day, hour by hour, question by question, easy to drill down. There's even audio and video from the show after the fact. Techguylabs.com, no charge, no sign up even. You just go there and click things, and it's all happy, happy fun time. We were talking about LastPass. You should use it. That's the one. I think yesterday I talked a little bit about a great study that surveyed normal users and security experts about what they do with their computers. And there was quite a disparity. I think normal users, the number one security tip from normal users was get an antivirus. Nope, doesn't work. Because most of the attacks these days are zero-day flaws. They don't. The antivirus doesn't know about them yet. That's how fast this stuff spreads. So an antivirus gives you maybe a false sense of security. You have an antivirus if you have Windows 8 or later. You can get a free antivirus from Microsoft, Microsoft.com/security essentials. That's fine, but it's not enough. The experts say the most important thing to do, update your system, keep it up to date, and all the software, especially software that goes online. That's what's important. But they also say get a password manager and use it. That's like not even in the imagination. It's not even in the wildest dreams of the normal users. It's the experts say it. So my password manager, and the one I recommend, although there are many, and most of them are fine, is LastPass. That's the one I use. Free to use. If you want to use it on multiple devices, multiple mobile devices, you can pay $1 a month for the premium version. I'd do that just to keep them in business because they're such a good company. And I highly recommend it. LastPass can generate strong, unique passwords. That's the other thing that's important. Don't reuse passwords on multiple sites. Each site should have its own long, strong password. Problem with long, strong passwords? Hard to remember. That's why you have a password wallet, a password manager. It keeps all your passwords for you. You do have to remember one password, the password manager's password. But that's it. You could write that one down. Highly recommend it. David is next from Venice Beach, California. My son called me today saying, hey, I found a house for you to buy in Venice Beach. It's only $12 million. I said, yeah, no. I said, and who would live there, Henry? He said, me. He loves Venice. So how are you doing? What can I do for you?
Good afternoon. I'm well. Thank you. My question is about a Panasonic video camera.
Yeah.
I've been checking it out in the store. I purchased it finally, so now it's being shipped from New York, so I don't have it in front of me. However, it's a 4K, and when I turn it on, and I move my hand in front and back in front of the camera, there's a little lag, and I was wondering if that's normal or if
you can fix that. That's normal. If you think about it, recording 4K video is a lot of bits, a lot of pixels. And that means there's a lot of data coming across the bus that the sensor has to pick it up. So it's completely normal for there to be some lag. That's just the way it is, unless you spend a lot of money on a very, very fast camera.
Oh.
So don't worry about it. You're not looking at what's going on. You're looking through the viewfinder, so you won't notice any lag anyway.
What if I do look at the viewfinder itself while I'm shooting?
Well, that's fine, but the lag is only between how long it takes for the thing to happen in real life and then how long it takes for it to register on the viewfinder. That lag is normal because the camera is processing, but the recording will be normal. You shouldn't have any issue on the recording.
Well, that was pretty fast and easy.
Yeah.
Just because it's so big, right? The 4K.
Yeah, it's just big. You know, in fact, it wasn't so long ago, just a few years ago, that HD 1080p was hard to work with. You know, cameras, if your camera did it, the files that you got would be very hard to edit and playback, even though you could put it on YouTube. Nobody had enough computer power to watch it. That was only a few years ago. Now we're doubling it. Instead of 1080p, it's 2160p. And so it's twice as many lines and twice as many pixels across as well. So you've quadrupled the amount of data you're handling. And that means everything has to be four times faster to keep up. That's why there's a little lag. It's not unusual. And it shouldn't affect you, really. It's not a bad thing.
Right on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the call. Enjoy. What are you going to be shooting 4K video of?
A $12 million house here.
Hey, send it along. Henry will be very glad to. I say, Henry, I bought it for you. He said, Dad, the down payment's only $100,000. I said, I don't think so, Henry. You might want to look at that brochure a little more closely. That's how much you pay to look at the house.
Whoa. Documentary on Muscle Beach. I'm a regular at Muscle Beach.
I love Muscle Beach.
Yeah.
Are you a lifter down there, or you just go down there and shoot video?
No, I do both, actually. I'm a lifter, but we lift people. We do acrobatics. The one in Santa Monica, not in Venice Beach.
Yeah, the Santa Monica Muscle Beach is so awesome. You know, my wife does the rings down there. She can go all the way across and all the way back.
I must know her. I'm always there.
She's good. She's amazing. Hey, that's nice. You're one of those guys down there, huh?
I'll go and greet her today.
Okay, but be careful. Don't get too much sun, okay? Use the sunscreen.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Take care, David. Nice to talk to you. It's so much fun. You know, it's on the beach. They've got all the weightlifting equipment, and the guys are down there, and they're so big and strong, and it's pretty cool. It's cool stuff down there. It's exactly what you'd expect. In Los Angeles. You're living up to the dream, you know, the sunny dream. David in Salt Lake City, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, David.
Hey. How's it going?
It's going well. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. Hey, I have a bunch of different email addresses on different domains, and I'm just really getting sick of the spam and all that. And
oh, yeah.
Not moving to Google. The downside is I can't figure out how I can send from Google on those different domains.
Say that again. You want to send from Google using your non-Google domains. Is that it?
Right. Is that even possible?
Or yeah. Yeah, that is possible. It's Google calls that, I can't remember the term. So you want your return address to be a Gmail address? Tell me exactly what you're looking to do.
Okay, if I'm getting email from Leoville and some twit.tv, I want to send it back from Leoville or from twit.tv or something like that.
You want to send my email back to me from the same address?
No, okay, I'm sorry. No, I was just using those examples.
So your address is xyz@gmail.com, but you're receiving something at xyz.hotmail.com.
.com.
You want to respond to it, but have the response address be your xyz@gmail.com address. Is that right?
xyz.com.
Okay. Yeah. By the way, the word came to me. The word is delegation. Google calls that delegation when you respond from a Google address and use another address. I think that's what you want to do, right?
Okay. Yeah. I think that sounds like
it. So go into the settings and you can choose an account that it should come from. You can also change the reply to in your email client so that the reply to is xyz.com.
I understand
what you want to do, because I want to do that too, because I use Gmail, but my my address that I want people to use is Leoville.
Right, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So that's that. You should do two things. You change the reply to be your xyz.com address, and then go into Google and look at the delegation options.
Delegation. Okay, see, that's what I wasn't finding with delegation. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's the term they use. Came to me. It's not. It doesn't leap to mind because it doesn't really make any sense, but that's what they call it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know, I put caller ID on my house. Well, not exactly caller ID, but when anybody rings my doorbell, I know it's them because I have the Ring video doorbell. This was so easy to install. The Ring video doorbell just takes the place of your wired doorbell on your house. If you don't have a wired doorbell, you know, you have one of those sticker doorbells that rings wirelessly, it'll work there too. It even has a lithium ion a rechargeable battery in here and a USB port, and you can actually charge this. It'll last about a year. But here's what's cool about it. So it was easy. I took my old doorbell off. There were two wires coming out. They give you everything you need, by the way, to install. Look at this. You get the screwdriver, the bits, the drill bit, even as a level, all those screws you stuff. And it's very easy. They've got videos on how to install it. And then, this is so cool, when somebody rings your doorbell, it rings not only the doorbell in the house, but it rings the Ring app on your phone, on your Android or iOS device. I hear the doorbell ring, even if I'm at work, because it goes over the internet. And even better then, I can say, accept or deny. I can actually talk to, because there's a microphone and a speaker in here. I could see who's ringing my doorbell, and I can talk to them. And I could say, "Hey, I'm in the shower. Can you leave the UPS guy? Can you leave the box on the doorstep?" It is awesome. It also turns out about 95% of burglaries happen during the day when you're not home, and almost always the burglar rings the doorbell. So you're going to have great, clear video. Let me show you. I have the app on my phone. You have great, clear video of the bad guy. So I have it set. You can do motion detections. I have it set to do motion detection and doorbell detection. So somebody was at my doorbell at 8:44. Actually, they didn't ring the doorbell. They just came in the house. So I can go back and look at the video. There's the front door. Look how good that picture is. Crystal clear. Oh, yeah, that's my daughter. That's cool. She's coming in. If somebody rings the doorbell, I can answer it. I can talk to them. It's awesome. Now, it doesn't open the door. It's not that. It's just a doorbell. But it's just the smartest doorbell you ever saw. Installing it is easy, and it protects your home, and I love it. And that's why probably Time Magazine said it was one of their top 10 gadgets of the year last year. See, there's a missed call. That's somebody ringing the doorbell. Let's see if we can. Yeah, what I should do for this ad is get somebody to go to my house and ring the doorbell. Oh, yeah. That's Aiden and his mom. Yeah. And you can even hear it.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Right now, you can get the Ring Video Doorbell for $174. We're going to give you $25 off when you go to ring.com/tech guy. I love it. ring.com/tech guy. The Ring Video Doorbell. It's like caller ID for your house. And thank them. We thank them for supporting the Tech Guy podcast. I read an article. I guess I didn't bookmark it. Shoot. That spam is down. The number of spam messages down to something for the first time ever. This comes from Symantec, I think. Yeah. So they provide spam filtering hardware. Let's see if I can find that. Spam is down. Symantec. I'll Google that. 12-year low on spam. For years, it's been going up, 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 up. According to Symantec, A new report released this week. Annoying spam emails are a 12-year low. Isn't that wild? Doesn't seem right. But it might be that because we've, you know, the law enforcement's making some headways with spammers. That's from the Symantec Intelligence Report of June. All right, now what do I do? I'm really out of luck here. I just have to live with... Do you think when Windows 10... See, oh, I'm so stupid. I'm mad at myself. So here's what I did. I had a working registered copy of Windows 8.1 on here because I bought this. And then I accepted the Microsoft invitation. So Wednesday, if I hadn't messed with this, I would have gotten Windows 10. But then I thought, oh, I want to demonstrate Windows 10 on the new screensavers yesterday because Paul was doing a segment. So I made a recovery disk using the recovery control panel, and I thought wisely. And then Alex had an ISO. It wasn't the latest release, but beta releases ago. So I put that on there, and it's on there now. And then I thought, well, but the problem is you can't activate it. I was hoping I could update it. Because if you can update to 10.240, you've got the official Windows 10. That was my dream, my fantasy, my hope. Didn't happen because the Windows serial numbers no longer work because the activation servers have been turned off for the beta. The beta program's over. Do you think, so this is 10.130, do you think I will get updated at some point? Or I can't authenticate it. I can't authenticate it, and I'm not going to be able to update it. Yeah, they shut down insider activation. Do you think, though, July 29th, I'll be able to authenticate? But I don't have a serial number, but I'm sure I can find one.
You're a prime example why I never update anything, because I don't know what I'm doing. And you do, and things are messed up. I have like two past versions of my MacBook because I have no idea how to upgrade anything.
So frustrating. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I need to come here and have you guys do it.
No, I'll just mess it up like I did that one.
Because I'm still on, what am I on, Mavericks? I think I'm on Mavericks for my late 2013 MacBook Pro.
Yeah, you should update. That's a little easier.
I'm afraid I'm going to lose everything.
But I made a recovery disk. See, I thought I was being all smart and stuff. But I don't know what's going on. Wait for the Windows 10 release. Get a key. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. That's the number. If you want to talk high tech. Let's get back to the phones. Let's see. Who should I start with here? Earl in Lakeside, California. Hello, Earl.
Yeah, hello.
How you doing?
Hey, got a question. My daughter's here from China. She's going back over there. She teaches over there. And she wanted to find what was the best phone. And she's looking at the Samsung S5.
Well, she should get one in China because the best phones, it's so funny, American Android enthusiasts are all mad because we can't get the Chinese, like the Mi 4 or the Mi Note. Xiaomi only sells it in China, and it's often widely considered by many to be the best Android phone. So what she should probably do is just wait till she gets back to China and buy a Xiaomi.
But they put their software on it. She can't use Google.
You can install the Google Play services and all of that stuff. It may not come with it. You're right. It's that their Xiaomi operating system, the MIUI operating system. But it does allow you, it's my understanding, to install the Google stuff on it. And then you get the best of both worlds. Does she speak Chinese? I figure she probably does, right?
No.
No, okay. Well, maybe you don't want a phone in Chinese, that's for sure, right?
Yeah, well, she teaches English over there.
Great. Well, okay, so if you want to get a couple of things to think about. First of all, when you buy a phone in the U.S., It is the hardware is designed to work with United States carriers and their frequencies. Those frequencies vary.
She has an unlocked one.
It's not the lock. It's the radios. So you want to make sure if you buy a phone, for instance, the iPhone radios do work in China, but not all. But you might. I'm not sure about the Galaxy S5. I'm not sure because they sell different versions for different regions. There's a Chinese S5 and there's an American S5. There's also a Latin American and a Hong Kong and a Singapore. There's S5s for every region. And those radio frequencies may be different. Now, an iPhone should work because Apple makes, as to my knowledge, one iPhone with all the frequencies. The iPhone you buy in the U.S. will work in China. But I can't guarantee that the American version of the Galaxy phones will work in China.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Yeah. They're telling me that she's correct, that the Google services are not available in China at all, whether you have it on your phone or not, because Google doesn't play in China. So it sounds to me like no matter what phone you get, there might be some issues. I would get an iPhone. I think that's the safest bet is an iPhone. And you can get it from any carrier. Although, remember, you're going to want a GSM phone. Interesting factoid, however, that the Verizon iPhone, which is ostensibly not GSM, does in fact work fine when you put a local SIM in it, not a Verizon SIM. She'll probably want to use a local SIM if she's in China, because otherwise it gets very expensive very fast. So that's another issue. You do want an unlocked phone so that you can use a Chinese carrier in China. The Galaxy S5 dual SIM model is, thank you, Scooter X, G9009D. And it does support, because it has two SIMs, the radios in China. So that's what you'd need to do, is be careful. Don't buy an American S5. Buy the special S5 design for the Chinese market, the 9009D. It's complicated. Really is. Ben's on the line from Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
Well, how are you?
Good. Say, I've heard you talk about second factor authentication and LastPass all the time, right?
Right.
So my question is, do you think we'll ever, move past that and...
Yes.
I hope so.
I hope so, exactly.
Because, wouldn't it be simpler to have, fingerprint reading or something rather than having to...
Well, in fact, that is two-factor authentication. Okay. So the idea of multi-factor authentication is you can have something you know, like a password, something stored in your head, something you have, like a dongle or a special credit card that does a number... Or something you are, and that would be your fingerprint, your iris. Any combination of two of those three is two-factor authentication. In fact, in some ultra-secure facilities, network operations and so forth, they may do three-factor authentication. You go to the door, you enter your password, you tap it with a special card, and then it does an iris scan or a handprint measure and lets you in. Three factors. That's, of course... even more secure. The theory is a bad guy could get your password or guess your password, but even if he does, if you're using another factor like a card or your iris or your fingerprint, chances are he's not got that and your password. So it's really much more secure. Most people now, most banks are using two-factor as you experienced it, which is you enter the password, the bank says, okay, what's your cell phone number? We're going to send you a code. And when you get that code, enter it, and now you can enter the bank. Or we're going to give you a card. I have a card, a SafePass card from the Bank of America. It has a little button on the front. It's just a credit card size thing, but it's got a little circuitry in it. You press a number on it, and it gives you a secret 6-digit code that you can enter in. That's also two-factor. But you're right. Fingerprint would be great. In fact, that's one of the reasons the iPhone is so popular, because Apple has implemented an excellent fingerprint. And that can be your second factor. In fact, you can use that with LastPass. So you enter your LastPass password and then you use your fingerprint to say, yes, it really is me. That's much better. Yeah.
Because I love my iPhone 6, you know, with the fingerprint reader.
Yeah. Well, Microsoft Windows 10 has a new feature called Windows Hello. It does require a special camera. New Windows 10 machines will have that camera that is kind of like the Microsoft Kinect device that they had in the Xbox. And that will do face recognition. So you'll literally walk up to your computer, say, log me in. It'll look at you and say, yeah, that's you. And it'll let you in. Now, of course, we've seen some of these systems and they haven't been very accurate. You have face recognition on some Android devices. It's not very accurate. If you put on glasses, all of a sudden it stops working. And there's some question about whether somebody could just hold up a picture of you. And it would say, yeah, that's you. Not with Hello. Hello, one of the reasons you need a special camera in Hello, it has depth sensing. You can tell if it's a 2D picture or a 3D. And I suspect it also has infrared sensing. You can see if there's blood flowing through your veins. And if there's not, it says, that's not you. So we're getting better at this. You know, the real thing is let's get rid of passwords. Passwords are a terrible system.
Yes, they are.
they're really, you know, there's all sorts of flaws. It's hard to remember. So what we're hoping is that something will replace passwords. Yeah. Do you use LastPass, right?
Well, no, I just hear that.
You should.
You recommend it.
Yeah. And do you use two-factor with banks and important secure websites?
Yeah.
Good. Good. I tell you, I used two-factor with LastPass when they had that hack a few weeks ago. I didn't worry about it because I knew I was secure. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I know. No Mac man. That's what I'm trying to do. I made the recovery drive yesterday on the Dell, and now it won't let me. And I did try turning off secure boot. The problem with that is, yeah, it'll boot, but then you can't access the internal hard drive because it's not secure boot. So it's a catch-22. I did. I booted off the USB key. You can't do that unless you turn off secure boot. Then you boot off the USB key, and then you can't modify the internal hard drive. Hello, Chris Marquardt.
Hello, Leo. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
Good. How was your journey?
Nice.
Nice. Lots of castles and cities. And
I didn't realize. You should have told me. It's like all Bavaria is what it was. I even bought a pair of lederhosen.
Well, it looks like Bavaria, but it's not all Bavaria.
It fits
the stereotype.
Cologne's not Bavaria, sure. But once I got to the south, that was Bavaria.
How was Heidelberg?
I loved Heidelberg. Beautiful city.
I was there like 3 weeks ago, actually. Almost the same time you were there.
Darn it. Did you go to the castle?
No, I was there to talk to a publisher.
You actually do things. You live in Germany. You don't have to be a tourist. I had some good beer. Chris, how are you? Thank you. I had some. Thank you.
I bet you did.
A bunch of versts. It was fun.
Of course you did.
I had a lot of fun.
Of course you did. And you were on a nice ship, too?
Yeah, it's a beautiful ship. River cruising is fun. It's very slow.
It's a very, very slow, and it's this constant landscape moving pass. And
yeah.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, because sometimes, like, you're going like this. In fact, at one point, the river was too low because it was so hot, and the captain wanted everybody off the boat so he could get, you know, he said, we're only going to have about a foot of clearance, so I want, and it's going to scrape a little bit, you won't like it, so we're going to put you on a bus, and the bus goes, like, 10 miles, and the boat meets us 3 days later, practically. No, but many hours later.
Oh, by the way, you have an email with an assignment review, just FYI.
Let me get that.
Yep.
I get that.
Really? So they made you drive on a bus? Ride on a bus
well,
for a while?
Well, you can, but it's much faster going on a bus because the bus goes straight and the boat's going.
Yeah. Oh, I see that.
It was fun. It was very relaxing. Very relaxing. That's the best part about it.
Which part did you like most? Which city did you like most?
Würzburg was great. The Würzburg residence.
Würzburg is amazing.
It's amazing. I was told that liking Rotenburg is kind of a joke because it's such a tourist. It's like liking Pier 39 or Disneyland. But I did enjoy it.
It's on the same level as Heidelberg. Heidelberg is one of these other things that has so many tourists. But hey, well.
But Rotenburg was really neat. Such a fun medieval town. Actually, every town was great. Every town had. I loved Bamberg. That was fun. Nuremberg was great. Passau was great. So there was I would say I enjoyed every stop. There wasn't a bad stop in the bunch.
Good. How did you like the wine along the Rhine?
The wine is great. We drank a lot of delicious wine. I'm not crazy about bull's blood. Okay, I could do without that.
Yeah, well, we don't really do that. That's nobody really drinks that. That's just for the tourists.
The Franconian wine, not exactly wonderful. That's probably the equivalent of New York State wine in the United States.
All right.
But, of course, there's wonderful Mosels and Rieslings and Gewürztraminers. Good. And I love all good stuff, yeah. Hey, here we go. Chris Marquardt is here, and the reason I mention that, because he is our digital guru, our photographer, joins us most weeks to talk about digital photography, getting stuff. Better pictures, stuff. We were talking about my trip, took a lot of pictures, 1,400 pictures, which isn't a lot good for me. I mean, that was a three-week trip, but I haven't gone through them yet.
You had to spend all the time like drinking beer and
yeah, I was busy
doing German things, right?
Yeah, I was busy.
Much too busy.
A lot of fun though. I had a great time, and boy, those Baroque castles, pretty amazing. A friend of mine said, "Boy, how do they dust all that?" I never thought of that.
I've no idea.
No idea. So we had an assignment, as you may remember. We asked people to take pictures illustrating the word or concept sweet, and there's a lot of different interpretations of sweet.
Yeah, a lot of donuts and things, a lot of cakes. A lot of,
I resisted that. You know, I had pictures of amazing desserts on the boat, but I decided not to. That would be too
it's
obvious.
Too obvious, isn't it?
Yeah. But then yeah, I didn't come up with anything. So,
but then there are also there's this other category that's just people pictures that where people would go, oh sweet, right?
Yeah, pictures of your kitty cat or your kid. That kind
yeah,
of
not
thing.
not even that. Just something that is cool in some way, amazing in some way. Yeah. You would so we have a few of those, and pets, lots of pets, and it's a good selection, a good
sweet
selection.
Is so generic, and almost anything can fit that. Yeah,
it is, and I made a selection of three pictures to review again. The first one is by L. Swan, a boy and his cat. And when I looked at that, it's a black and white photo.
Sweet.
You see a boy and a cat from behind. It's there's of course the sweetness of a child in the picture and a pet in the picture. But then the other thing that made me go sweet was the light in the picture. Like if you see the light in the picture, it's backlit. The light's coming from a window and from some screens. So if you look along the side of the child and the cat, they have this what we call rim light or hair light, which makes it just such, it gives it so much depth, you know? For example, at the top where the hair of the boy and the curtain in front of the window almost are at the same brightness. Just imagine that hair light wouldn't be there. You wouldn't see the you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. The hair would pretty much melt into the curtain. So just by that little strip of light up there, it just becomes so deep. It really adds this layering to it. So having things backlit is almost always a good idea.
Really? Because our instructions from day one were get the sun behind your back so that you're not backlit.
Well, it can work. But now you take a portrait of someone and you have the sun behind you. Guess what that person will do with their eyes?
Squint.
They'll squint. Yeah. That's not going to work.
Plus, it flattens everything out. And
it doesn't make it look nice. I mean the worst place to put a light is right on the camera. I mean, that's what most cameras where they
flashes.
Have the flash. But that is never nice because it's coming from the front. So if you have the light come from somewhere else, and in this case, straight at the camera, that actually adds quite a lot of interest to the picture.
Nice picture, El Swan. Next one's from Pixel Pusher.
By Pixel Pusher.
Sweet. This is fireworks.
Well, yes, but this is a quite technical picture. So Pixel Pusher writes that this was 12 years in the making because what it is an HDR picture. Now, let me explain. An HDR picture is where you have something that has both very bright and very dark in it, and the camera can't handle that. So you would either overexpose the bright or underexpose the dark. And HDR pretty much means you take two exposures, one that's brighter, one that's darker, and then combine them using software. And usually that requires the thing in front of the camera to not move, like a landscape or architecture. That's HDR material. But as soon as things move, as in fireworks, it gets really hard to get this right. And apparently he's got a really fast camera, so he made an HDR of fireworks with two exposures. And the way this looks now is very different from how you usually see the fireworks. Normally you see them like just the lights. Now this has also the smoke trails in it plus the lights, and they're not overexposed. It's a really interesting kind of thing. I've never really seen a fireworks picture like this before.
Fireworks are not that hard. You just point the camera, put it on a tripod and open the lens and let it sit there for a while and you got some fireworks. But something like this is hard.
It's different, yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
So that's a very, very technical picture. And the third one is by our moderator, Renee Silverman.
Renee!
And this is just a funny picture. I mean, there's this guy on the picture with a beard eating some ice creams in a setting. It's a very, almost a fisheye kind of lens. You see the distortion at the edges. Looks like, yeah, you're looking through a fisheye. And the person is in focus. That's where you want the focus to be because people are important in pictures. There's lots of context in there, but it's not too much sharpness in the background. I like it. I really like
it. One of the things I like about this is there's a little story going on. You look at this picture, and the more you look at it, the more you realize. Yep. He's wearing a hospital bracelet. Yep. He's got a long beard and long hair, and you start to make some connections and think, you know, maybe this guy, this is the first time he's had a really good ice cream cone in a while. You know, maybe he's homeless. I don't know. Maybe he's been ill. And my mind starts to, you know, yep, play with it. And that's fun. I like a picture that makes you think. That's nice.
Yep, that's pretty much what makes a good picture. Or a lot of the time, it's you're not telling the whole story. You're leaving things open. You are putting things in there that are unusual. And that kind of provoke you to do something. If you show everything, if you show the entire story right away, yeah, there's no story left and people are just going to go to the next picture. But that's why this picture kind of grabbed my attention, because it was so full of things that give you the opportunity to fill in the blanks.
You can also taste the ice cream. You know it's cold. You
totally. Kind
of, it's a sensuous picture. You can actually feel the coldness of the ice cream and taste, yes, the chocolate. It's kind of a nice job, Renee. Great picture.
Yep.
Absolutely. Fun. Now, remember, this isn't a competition, and I understand that it's absurd to even contemplate reviewing photography on the radio, but it's fun anyway. We do it. Chris Marquardt gives us a new assignment every month. You will have 4 weeks to take pictures illustrating the new assignment. You'll tag them with the word, upload it to the Flickr group, the Tech Guy Flickr group. Renee Silverman, our moderator, will accept your picture. And maybe in 4 weeks we'll be looking at one of your shots on the radio.
We'll certainly do that.
What is the assignment this month?
The word this time is sour.
Oh, you did sweet.
Ooh,
sour is going to be challenging.
So many,
yeah,
different ways.
Yep. Sour is going to be fun. All right, so take that picture. We don't care what kind of camera. You didn't hear us even talk about the cameras in those last three pictures. What we care about is the composition, the image. Sometimes about the technical details, sometimes about just the feeling you get when you look at it. Upload as many as one picture every week. That means you have four chances to upload a sour picture at Flickr.com. By the way, Flickr's free. They just re-added the pro account, which is nice. And I'm a big fan. So join our Tech Guy group and a great community. You'll find more of Chris at discoverthetopfloor.com. When are you coming to the States? Usually you come here for the summer. Are you going
to
do that
this year? I'll come in October to San Diego and to New York City. We'll be holding some sweet workshops over the weekends.
All right. So if you want to know more about his workshops, discoverthetopfloor.com. Hey, thanks, Chris. It's always great to see you. I'm sorry I didn't get to see you when I was in Germany, where you live.
Yeah, that's because I live here. I don't vacation here. I live here. I have stuff to do.
Yeah, well, next time, okay? Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Back to the phones we go right after this. I feel like I'm so close. But I don't really know where the Viewfinder Villa is, so.
Actually, you will find it on Google Maps.
Oh, I should have searched for it on Google Maps.
It's on there. It's on there.
What was
there.
I thinking?
It's all on there.
Yeah, it was really fun. I haven't been to Germany since 1967. So Yeah. So when I was a kid, I was 12. So
has it changed? Has it dramatically changed?
No.
No.
It's an interesting country. Now, again, we weren't in the hippest parts of Germany by any means.
Oh, you went the medieval route for sure. Yes,
I mean that's not right because I was in Berlin maybe 2009. So I take it back. I've been to Germany.
That was for a conference or something.
It was a geek cruise, and Henry and I we went to the Reichstag. We went to the Brandenburg Gate. We visited Checkpoint Charlie. It was a lot of fun. And that's a very different experience. Berlin is urbane and hip. Most of the places we went were not.
I know. I mean, I've done this exact tour at least from Amsterdam to Basel, and it's really the most picturesque parts of Germany. The beautiful castles. Gorgeous. We used to call them ABC cruise, another bloody castle.
Yeah.
Because like every day you see another,
basically
something that's like several thousand years old.
It was Nuremberg, Würzburg, Bamberg, Rotenburg.
It's all the Bavaria in there.
Yeah,
and Franconia.
It was fun. Yep. We had a great time. The food was great. People
and
were
lots
great.
Of beer there too.
Great
that's
beer.
Where that's
that
where
delicious best, Dunkel's beer.
Some of the best, arguably some of the best beer in Germany comes from.
Oh yeah, well we're in Bavaria, and like I said, I got Lederhosen. Reindeer leather Lederhosen.
You're wearing them right now?
No. And I got the shoes to match.
Oh, no.
Lisa got a little reindeer leather skirt and a dirndl top. Yeah. We really look like tourists.
Once you wear those, I want to see pictures.
Oh, there's pictures. Wait a minute. Let me see if
I can. There are pictures. Where did you put them? On Flickr?
I'm just going to make sure we're not gone. Let's see. Frederick Van Johnson took some. Let me see if I can find those.
Oh, he was with you on the group. Ah.
No. We wore them on the new screensavers the day we came back.
I see.
And he sent me. I bet you I have it in an email from him. Let me check. Because you got to see these. Actually, Lisa looked very fetching, very cute.
Yeah, dirndl does that to you, yep.
Yeah, dirndls are great. Let's see, Frederick's email. Anyway. Well, yeah, I had a blast. It was a lot of fun. No, I'm going to find it.
Because we all want to see them right now.
You want to see... Well, now that I brought it up, I really should...
Did you also get one of those German hats with a...
Yeah, I have one. Well, it's Austrian, but yeah. They told me, it's all the same. Austria, Germany, it's all the same.
Don't tell that to the Austrians.
Oh, man, I can't find it. Oh, well. I'll find it. I'll post it somewhere.
All right.
Probably Chatroom sent me a link, but I haven't seen it. Oh, actually, you know what? Lisa probably sent it to me. Let me look it on there, Lisa. Problem is, I have so much mail from Lisa that I'll never find it. Yeah, I guess not. Oh, well. You'll just have to imagine me Lederhosen.
Yeah, traumatizing.
See you next week.
See you next Sunday.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Take care.
See ya. Bye-bye. It was very traumatizing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you want to talk high tech, I'd love to do it with you. Going back to the phones and Clyde from Sherman Oaks, California. Hi, Clyde.
Hey, hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I am great. How are you?
Okay. Just a little nervous about what you were talking about earlier. Today about the cars being hacked and where the cars are losing control, or a car can lose control like Chryslers or Jeeps.
Right.
And I have a new automobile. Okay, well, that by new I mean I just bought it a few months ago. It's a 2014 Toyota, and I wonder. I'm trying to figure out if my car would lose control as a result of being hacked. In that I have a telephone that. I use with my Toyota.
No, that's fine because the phone only has a USB connection into the Toyota. That's not sufficient. The hack on the Jeep involved using the 3G access that was built into the entertainment unit of the Jeep. Built in. My Audi has the same thing. It has a T-Mobile connection. If you have OnStar, a General Motors car, OnStar uses a cell. So not to say that those are vulnerable, but that was the first step, was some way that a hacker, even across the world, could get to your car via the internet. And that's what they did. They actually were able to hack that Jeep via the internet using a Sprint mobile connection built into the entertainment system. The real flaw, and I'm sure the flaw Fiat Chrysler's fixing and the flaw that is in a lot of systems, is that the entertainment unit and the computer running the car, the braking, the ignition, all of that stuff, are not physically separated. They are connected in many cars, and this was, a cost saving by something called a CAN bus, which is, think of it as an internal car network. So that means if you can find a vulnerability in the multimedia stuff, you might be able to cross that software-only barrier into the car's electronics, and that's the risk, because then you can do things like, you know, turn off the brakes. We saw this before. I think, was it 2020 or 60 Minutes? I think it was 60 Minutes. Was it Diane Sawyer was in a car and they turned off the brakes? Same thing. Now, that one was a physical hack. That meant the bad guys had to actually get access to your car to jack into the media system. This new one is more scary because they didn't need to get physical access to the car. They only needed to find the car on the internet and then, using flaws in the software, hack it. Those flaws are patchable, but there's this kind of fundamental problem that in every case, you know, the electronic system, whether it's on a plane that's flying the plane or a car that's driving the car, should not be connected, physically in any way connected, to the entertainment system. Car manufacturers are going to have to address that. But as you know, a new car takes years to design. We probably won't see those fixes for a while. And for a long time, the car manufacturers have said, no, don't worry. There's no way to get from the entertainment system to the car's electronics. Well, there is. And so we can't rely on that anymore. Not something to panic about.
Mm-hmm.
Not something to worry about. Car manufacturer, this is good news because car manufacturers now will pay attention to this and fix it. The bad news is if this exists but no one knows about it. Now, the other thing is somebody has to target you, and it's unless you're are you messing with the CIA, Clyde? Have you been a whistleblower at the NSA? Erin Brockovich, she should worry. You know, the rest of us probably aren't going to get somebody hacking into our system. It's a non-trivial thing to do. It's just that it's an issue that manufacturers have to pay better attention. But we're learning that everywhere. People haven't paid much attention to security. But now there's a very active group of hackers who are looking for flaws in this stuff, and they're finding them.
Right. Well, I'm thinking, you know, terrorists, you know, could come over here. I mean, it'd be a good way for ISA, whatever these guys are call themselves, you know.
But they don't want just an individual. I'll tell you what I would worry about. The security of our electrical grid, for instance. If there's cyber terrorism, it will happen on a much larger scale. And we know there are vulnerabilities. In fact, we've seen that in many of the computer systems that run the electrical grid, there are security flaws, and some of them even have malware on them. And that's a cause for real concern. Imagine what chaos would ensue if the electrical grid in the United States was shut down by a terrorist remotely. Far worse than having you drive off the road. Right? So they're not going after you.
I mean,
they're not going after you. And to my knowledge, there's no hack that would affect every car on the road. You have to do it onesie-twosie still. But it's something to be paying attention to. And I'm very glad that Fiat Chrysler did that recall. 1.4 million cars are being recalled back to the manufacturer so they can fix this flaw.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That's what I heard, yeah. I just wasn't sure now that you told me that it's not controlled by the internet, I just wasn't sure. I have, of course, an internet, but
not just from pairing your cell phone to the car, you're fine. At least so far. I shouldn't make any promises. These guys are ingenious. The guy who did this is well known. He's what we call a white hat hacker. He's not doing it to make money or to bug people. He is a guy who goes around looking for flaws, and he's made a lot of money finding bugs and telling companies about them.
Well, it's good that he did that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm just worried that the bad guys, you know, the real bad guys who don't like America are trying to take over America.
Yeah, well, you know, there's lots of things they could do. There's probably things that are easier for them to do than that.
I would think so. Yeah. I would think
most,
so. I think that, mm-hmm.
Most of the kind of terrorist-type attacks are state-sponsored. And in other words, we know that China, for instance, has a fairly large division in its military of hackers. And that they are actively looking to hack American companies, trying to get information for economic reasons.
Right, right.
So
right.
These skills are very high-level skills. It's not going to be the kid in Bulgaria who's figured out a way to drive you off the road. There's no incentive for him to do that. But state-sponsored right. hacking is something we should probably be very concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate that information because I was wondering what.
Don't worry.
Okay. Yeah.
Don't worry. Remember in Battlestar Galactica, the new version, Commander Adama had the old starship, the Galactica, and he was adamant. He says, "No, we're not going to ever connect this to the public internet or whatever it was in the future, whatever they call that. We're going to have." They had old phones that were wired. They didn't have wireless phones, and everybody mocked him. In fact, they were going to mothball Galactica because it was just so out of date. And then the Cylons hacked everybody else. They couldn't get Galactica because it wasn't on the grid. The problem is we're putting everything on the grid now, including your thermostat, medical gear. Everything is on the internet, and that's risky. When your car is on the internet, you see what happens. Charlie Miller said to himself, I wonder if I could find that car, find its IP address, hack it. And he did by remote control. That is scary. Somebody in the chat room says, well, that's no problem. You just buy a 57 Chevy. You'll be safe. That's the Battlestar Galactica of cars. We're going to go back to the phones in a little bit. Diane's coming up from Norco. She's got trouble with her VoIP. I hate it when that happens. VoIP trouble. We'll go where the VoIP are in just a little bit. 888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. Another hour to come. Website techguylabs.com. That's where I put all the stuff I talk about. Actually, James DeRuvo does that. Thank you, James. Tip of the hat to you. And Josh Windisch. And my office, and they put the audio there and the video and your comments and everything. TechGuyLabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, and all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere. In the U.S. or Canada, outside that area, you can use the internet. Call us via Skype. Let's go to Diane. She's on the line from Norco, California. Hi, Diane. Oh, wait a minute.
McCall.
Yes, it's good to talk to you. What can I do for you?
Well, got a VoIP system in a small office. There's two desk phones for it. And been having a variety of issues with it.
Ah.
One of the most annoying things are phantom calls that come in, and it's have business hours set on the phone. So the desk phone should only ring between 9 and 5 Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
But all during the day and after hours, the phones will ring. And instead of being a phone number on the caller ID, it's just like a couple of digits. So talk to.
And when you pick up, what happens? Is there anybody there?
No, nothing.
Nothing.
All you do is push reject and make them go away.
Well, I don't think you have a very good VoIP system in your office. Who provides that?
Ring Central.
Oh, that's our sponsor, Ring Central, huh? But that's not good.
Yeah, which I've had for a few years based on your recommendations. And, you know, and loved it for a long time.
We still use it, but I've never had that problem. But, you know, Ring Central they have to connect to the public telephony network through providers, right? They're just they just sit there, they get the internet. And I'm wondering, given that you're getting these strange calls, if that's not the provider that RingCentral is using? It's not farther downstream, you know what I'm saying?
Well, according to RingCentral Tech, it's malicious trying to get in through my router.
Oh. Wow. Do you have an IT department or person?
No. No, small office. I have everything.
You're the IT guy.
I am.
Let's see. Boy, I don't know if I'm going to be much help. I don't, on the surface of it, I'm not sure that advice from RingCentral is accurate. Although I guess anybody who's attacking you could be causing spurious data coming across your phone. Your phone is now on your computer network. It's part of the computer network. So, we're a media company, so we expect attacks. So we have very heavy-duty security hardware running on all the lines and everything. So if a hacker tries to attack us, they're attacking something that is not bulletproof. Probably nothing is bulletproof, but it's designed to withstand attack. If you just have a consumer-grade router on the internet, and I bet you do.
Yeah. It's a business office. I have to pay for business DSL. It's HP DSL.
Are you using the DSL provider's router?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
I almost wondered if I put a second router on it.
Yeah, sure.
If that might help?
Sure. The problem, though, sometimes with VoIP is the closer the VoIP is to the public internet, the better. The more routers you add, you can add latency and so forth. I hate to say it, but if RingCentral's right, then you need to get a fairly expert person in to kind of lock your systems down. Now, we don't have an IT department either, but we use a consulting IT guy who's very good. And that's kind of what you want to look for. Not somebody who will become an employee, but somebody you pay by the hour to come in there and consult with you and say, yeah, what you need is something more robust. Any good IT guy could immediately verify what RingCentral's saying. He could watch the traffic coming into your router and say, yeah, I see it. He'd know immediately.
Yeah, it's so sporadic that it's...
Well, there's logs, too. I mean, he'd be able to tell if that's real. But that's what you need. Obviously, you can't do that. But a good IT person can come in, can look at your logs, look at what's going on in the router, make recommendations for ways to fix the problem. In my opinion, it could be that, but it also could be upstream. It's not that RingCentral is getting hacked. I think that's unlikely. But their provider might be, some of that spurious traffic might be coming from their provider upstream. As I said, we've been using RingCentral here for, it's exactly now 4 years. We just celebrated our fourth anniversary in the studio. And nothing like that's ever happened. So it may be that what they're saying is accurate, but the only way to verify that is to get somebody who knows what they're doing.
Because I've had a couple of other issues with the service as well, I've never seen anything negative about RingCentral, and I love so much about them, but I had a couple of frustrating things, so I don't know if it maybe is my internet connection, because there's things like you dial in and you push my extension number, and it doesn't recognize it.
No, that's not
and
good.
They said that, because, it doesn't always hear on a cell phone. Well, somebody was calling me from a desk phone, and it wouldn't come through.
Yeah, that's not good.
And then I get the email.
That's not hacking.
A missed call.
Yeah.
That the phone never rang.
Right.
So it's all of these different issues. And, for a business office, and it's actually the Chamber of Commerce here. And
yikes. We should get this fixed. Yeah. Like I said, they are a sponsor, so disclaimer there. We've been using their service for 4 years and have not had those problems, but that doesn't mean that's not from them. When you tell them about that stuff, that doesn't sound like they're being very satisfactory in their response.
No, it's hit or miss when you call tech support with them on answers the phone.
Yeah.
Very, very hit or miss.
Yeah. It sounds to me it could be... it could be your network. It could be your installation. I think a good IT guy is going to go a long way to solving these problems.
Okay.
I know you have a limited budget, but... And I don't have any references or referrals for you for Narco, but, look around. There's going to be somebody... We have such a good guy. When you find a good guy, you hold on to them. Like, they're solid gold. And I've talked to you about Russell. In fact, it was Russell who recommended RingCentral to us. He'd use them for his, so I know that he feels pretty good about them. Next time I see him, I'll ask him if he's heard about any of these phantom call issues. Yeah, but it sounds to me like this is the problem. When you're using voice over the internet, it's reliant on your internet connection. Mm-hmm. And issues on your internet connection can, no matter what the company does, the VoIP company does, cause issues with VoIP. And that's some of the issues. Would you send me an email? I'll do a couple things for you. Send it to Leo at techguylabs.com. First of all, I'll escalate you at RingCentral. And then second, I will talk to Russell and see if he has a compadre in Norco that he recommends. Somebody would be good for IT. And, you know, it can be 10 hours. It could be less. A good IT person could come in and immediately pinpoint the issue. And the problem is doing your own IT is often more expensive, frankly, than getting somebody who knows what they're doing.
My time is stretched thin enough.
Yeah. So, and it's a very high, I mean, I would look at
you for a long
time. I'm the tech guy. I don't do my own IT. I've done it and I don't want to do it. It's a specialized thing. Now I would go to the support community, RingCentral. Have you done that? Community.ringcentral.com, because that's another place to go for to talk to users and customers. For instance, I'm seeing a message on the community, ghost calls from 1000, 1001, 120,
yes,
etc. Well, there's a post there on that. So there may be some helpful information there. Now, I've seen that before, by the way, with other VoIP solutions. And I do think that this is kind of something that VoIP might be more susceptible to. I occasionally on Skype get weird phantom calls like that. I can't really help you directly, but send me that email. I'll escalate it to RingCentral, see what they can do for you, and we'll see if Russell can recommend somebody. All right.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Thanks for the call. Good luck. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So here's one answer. You want to make sure that your phones only talk to, RingCentral's servers. What is happening is there is this SIP scanner out there. Oh. So this is a hacking issue. It is a hacking issue that's looking for VoIP phones to make calls or just cause problems. Your firewall can't control this, and that's right. That's probably why we don't experience it. And this is the kind of thing you know, if you're pretty handy, you might be able to do yourself, but an IT guy could look at this and say, oh, okay. Okay, so that's good. SIP Vicious, friendly scanner attacks. That's a great name, isn't it? SIP Vicious. Free SIP security testing suite scans IP addresses looking for SIP devices. A SIP device is that's the signaling interface protocol that's used by VoIP phones. They're called SIP phones because they use the internet, not the telephone network. Helps identify PBX extensions, provides a mechanism to crack SIP user passwords. It's a hacking tool. RingCentral says, we can't help you with that. We can just tell you how to configure your routers and your firewalls to block it. You want to block SIP signaling from all but RingCentral IP address ranges.
Steve on line 2 thinks he's got a solution for it. Okay. Regarding buying a business class router instead of, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to spend any more time on it. But, because really all of that goes back to getting an IT guy. Right, a good IT person will help you with all that stuff. You need to lock down the SIP ports on the router so that you only talk to RingCentral IP networks. Most small office, home office routers do not do this. You need an access control list. So that's the key. You need a better router. And that's kind of what Steve's saying. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. So I've been doing a little research into this issue. It turns out I didn't know this. I understand what RingCentral was now telling our caller. Because it turns out there is a hacker tool called, get this, SIP Vicious. Wasn't Sid Vicious the bassist for, Sex Pistols. Yeah. I blanked that out. Anyway, SIP is the protocol, the signaling protocol that's used on phones that use the internet instead of the phone system to make phone calls. So when you use a phone with Ring Central or some other voice over the internet product, it'll be a SIP phone. And what SIP Vicious does, it's a hacker tool that scans the internet looking for SIP phones. And what they're trying to do is two things. One, they're trying to get into your network, into your phone network, if they get the password. Then they can use your phone network to place long-distance calls. SIP Vicious Scanner, will identify active PBX extensions and has a built-in mechanism to crack passwords. And, you know, hackers use it just like they used to hack the phone system. This original phone freakers, the phone hackers, were trying to get free long-distance calls. They were blowing Cap'n Crunch whistles into the phone handset and all sorts of things. Well, this is kind of like that, only modern times, since many, many businesses now don't use phones from the phone company. They use internet-connected phones, and they're on the public internet. So the solution, I stand by, I think, my recommendation to get some help from a competent IT person. And we will put a link in the show notes to this message thread on the Ring Central forums. But the solution is to make sure your router does not allow phone access to anything but Ring Central's servers. Don't let other IP addresses connect to your phone. Now, that means probably you need a business class router. A consumer router will not have the capabilities, the access control list that you need to control who has access to your Ring Central phone system. But if you had that, you just say, hey, this phone can only talk to Ring Central and no one else. And that would solve the problem. It'd all go away. A good IT person worth his or her weight in gold. Benny on the line from Pasadena. Hello, Benny. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. What can I do for you?
So, my laptop, having troubles. I think I picked something up on it, so I'm afraid to log on. Bank websites and the Gmail. And so somebody got me a $50 Polaroid tablet to use temporarily. And I'm wondering, how secure is it?
Well, first of all, you know that even though it says Polaroid, it's not the same Polaroid that made the cameras.
Okay.
They went out of business a long time ago. They sold the name.
Oh,
and
wow.
So there are Polaroid is really some Chinese company that makes very cheap tablets and is hoping that you will look at the Polaroid brand name and go, oh, that's from Polaroid. That's got to be good. I'm impressed that it's only $50. I bet that's what you did.
Well, someone got it for me, but I need to check my email.
I think they're secure, but they're not more secure. Well, actually, they may be more secure than a computer. One of the advantages that mobile devices have is Android and iOS were developed after we became well aware of security issues. Windows and Macintosh operating systems were created before security was a big problem. So security's always been an add-on for those operating systems, more so for Windows than Mac. But Android and iOS, they knew when they developed them that mobile devices would be a real target for bad guys. So they're built in a way that is more secure to begin with. They're also not as complex. They can't do as much. So in a way, that's one of the reasons you use a router, for instance, to connect to the internet. It's still a computer, but it's a dumb computer. Dumb is good. Dumb means that you reject things you don't understand. And so there may be some advantage to using that Polaroid tablet. Because it is dumb. We'll grant you that. What are you worried about?
Well, the bad guys, getting my password when I log onto my bank site.
Well, so for instance, if you use that tablet on an open Wi-Fi network, which you probably will because it's portable, you really run the risk of people seeing what you're doing. And if, for instance, your email is not encrypted, your email password is not encrypted, it is on all modern email systems, but maybe you have your email through your internet service provider, and that bad guy just sitting there in the cafe watching what's going on sees your password he's kind of owned you because now he can access your email. You'll never know he has. And all he has to do is go around saying, hey, would you? I forgot my password. Would you send me a new one? And then he looks in your email and he's got your password.
Well, I'm in a closed system.
Good. You know? So that's the first thing is don't use that Polaroid tablet on an open Wi-Fi access point.
Okay. And I also have LastPass. So.
Good man.
So that's good.
Good man. Although, again, that won't protect you because it'll keep somebody from getting your password store, and it'll make you use good passwords. But if somebody grabs your password flying through the air, it doesn't matter whether you use LastPass or not. Who's your email provider?
Gmail.
Oh, you're golden. So Google is very good on this. In fact, Google has a couple of things that will help you. First of all, your password is encrypted no matter where you are, even on an open Wi-Fi access spot, so no bad guy can steal it. In fact, the whole transaction is secure. But Google also, at the bottom of your Gmail in the lower right, you can see who has logged into your Gmail account. People need to pay attention to this because you can tell if somebody else is accessing your email. Go down there and look at the recent accesses, where they're coming from, and so forth. It should be stuff you recognize. It might be – sometimes it's from a geographic location that you say, well, I'm not there, but maybe that's where your internet service provider is or your cell phone company is. But it's really cool that Google will show you who's accessing your inbox and from where. So that's in the lower right-hand corner of the Gmail interface. Gmail's secure. When you go to your bank, that's secure, of course, because your bank's encrypting transactions. So you don't have to worry about that. An Android device, if somebody doesn't get physical access to it, it's highly unlikely that you've got any malware on it. And my strong suggestion is don't download apps from strangers. Now, right. does that Polaroid tablet have the Google Play Store, the application store?
It says, Google settings.
You need to, if you don't have a place.
It does say Play Store.
It does or does not?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, good news. So that's good. So if you stick pretty much entirely to the Play Store for apps, or better yet, since you want this to be your secure device, you don't use any apps other than the ones that came with it, I think you're safe. I think you're good. I think that's a good choice for you to do the stuff that you really want to keep secure. You're not installing additional software on it. Google's keeping this pretty up-to-date, pretty secure. Make sure you patch it if you ever get patches. What Google's done, which is very smart, is they've moved most of the apps into the Play Store so that you're getting automatic updates. And that means it's more secure. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. And John in Los Angeles. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question. I have an iPhone 6 Plus, and I use the phone jack to plug in to my car to listen to music and stuff.
Yep.
And part of the phone jack broke inside.
Oh, so now, no.
I know. So the question I have is there a tool that I can pull that out with, or do I have to go replace the whole phone?
Yeah, there is. It reminds me of my son. My son has an iPhone as well, and he kept complaining, the connector's falling out. So I said, well, bring it to the iPhone repair store. There's a million of them, by the way, I'm sure, in your town. I said, bring it to the iPhone repair store, because a lot of times they can fix that. The iPhone repair guy looks inside it, takes a little tweezers, pulls out a big wad of fuzz, and says, yeah, you just got fuzz in the hole there. Just... And he says no charge for the fuzz removal. So so you got a little piece of the cable, lightning cable, broken up in there. I'm sure that they can just pry it out. But the iPhone repair people, they're everywhere, and almost certainly they can get it out. You could try pulling it out with tweezers if you've got some nice fine tweezers lying around.
Okay, well, that's what I was going to ask you, if it was going to affect anything if I tried.
I don't think you'll short circuit anything. Turn the phone off just in case.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Now, remember, with an iPhone, you could turn – and actually, this is true of all phones. You could turn the screen off by pressing the on-off button, but that's not – the phone's not off. You have to press and hold the button and then slide to turn off if you really want to turn it off. I would turn it off. Why not? It's probably a little bit of voodoo, but why not? Turn it off before you remove the offending connector. Richard in Placentia, California. Hi, Richard.
Leo, thank you again for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Hey, one quick comment on all these hackers people have been talking about today.
Yes.
Someone wakes up every morning and just says, whose life am I going to make?
Yeah, you know, who are these people?
I don't believe it. Unbelievable. Yeah.
You know, get a life. Use all that creativity, that brains, the ingenious. Yeah. Use it for good, not evil.
Unbelievable.
I know. I don't. I wonder myself, and yeah. I think part of it is that the internet, because it's ubiquitous now, maybe they're only it's 1/1,000th of 1% of everybody that just is kind of has a bad attitude.
Bad 1%.
But you know, but that small number is still, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of people, and that's all it takes is one to ruin your day. I agree with you. I don't understand it. I don't understand why there's bad guys.
Yeah.
Can't we all just get along?
We're trying, but some don't want to join the party, I guess.
I know. I just, you know, it's sometimes it saddens me, the human condition.
I'm sure you've touched on this subject before, but my daughter's brand-new Inspiron 5000.
Yes.
The fan keeps running and running and running.
Yeah.
The moment you turn it on, right out of the box.
Yeah.
And so, I've gone on the internet. I'm reading about BIOS and upgrading, but it's brand-new.
Yeah, so it's the latest BIOS, almost certainly. I'd call Dell just to say, hey. But usually what happens with these BIOS updates, they update the firmware to be less aggressive about having the fan blow. Now, the fan is trying to cool your computer off, and it's so there's two possibilities. One, it really is hot, and two, it's just being overzealous. If it's overzealous, we want to fix that, and that's what those firmware updates will do. Frequently, laptops will get updates, and those things will be fixed over time. Apple's done the same thing where they're just very aggressive fans, and then they realize, you know, we don't really need to do that. But the other possibility you shouldn't ignore is that your daughter is using it in such a way that it's actually heating up pretty hot.
Agreed. And she, I've asked about that, sitting on her lap, but it'll be even on a desktop, you know, sitting on her desk where, you know.
Is she playing a game, or what's she doing?
No, she's just using it mostly for school.
Okay. So like a word processor, that kind of thing.
Most of the time, I would say so, yeah.
That's not very demanding. But remember, if you have a lot of apps going at once, or even just the browser with a lot of tabs open, you can be really exercising the processor. And it could be it needs the fan, because modern processors get hot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're getting a lot of power in these processors, but as a result, they do tend to heat up. And so what happens often with a new laptop is manufacturers are perhaps overly prudent, and they turn the fans up more than they need to. And after a while, they go, maybe we don't need to do that, and they issue a patch.
There's a total adjustment that can be.
Did it do it from the first moment she opened it up?
Yeah. And right when you turn it on, it'll run for maybe 30 seconds, shut off, and 10, 20 seconds later, comes back on again.
Yeah.
And even to the point in the school library, is that your computer?
Oh, yeah, dear. Oh, dear. So it's louder than normal.
Yeah. So it seems to her, Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to presume that she's not doing something that's using up. Does it feel hot on the bottom?
That I haven't noticed.
Yeah, just see if it feels hot. I mean, if it doesn't feel hot, then I'm going to presume she's not doing something that is particularly, you know, onerous. And maybe it's just the firmware is asking the fans to turn on too much. Make sure the air intakes are clear, and she's not running a lot of background apps or a lot of tabs open in the browser. If you've got Flash, and maybe her schoolwork requires sites that use a lot of Flash, if you have a couple of three Flash things running, that can really, you know, exercise a processor. So I would call Dell, though. It may well be that it's defective, and if it is, Dell will say, "Well, that's not right. Maybe we better fix that."
Yeah. I thought I would call you first, even before I called Dell.
Yeah,
if they validated your thoughts, and I'll have her check open apps and what have you. You know, even prior to calling.
Yeah, and feel if it's hot on the bottom. But if it's not, and she's not doing anything unusual, I think a call to Dell is in order. One of the reasons I do send people to Dell is they're pretty good about that kind of thing.
Very good. Very good.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. Yeah, laptops are smaller. The space is tighter. We're jamming more stuff in there. The processors are faster. Nowadays, you know, you get a laptop that has a video card, too. That gets very hot. So there's always potential that these fans are needed. You can download from CPU ID. You can download a program that will look at the temperatures and actually tell you as it's running how hot it's getting, and then you can see if that's normal. In fact, you might want to do that before you go to Dell. Download CPU IDs. Well, let's see. They have Hardware Monitor Pro. They have tools that will monitor the temperature on a variety of different things on your CPU, on your motherboard, on your video card if you have one. It's a nice idea to kind of know. Most processors do not want to get hotter than, let's say, 40, 45 degrees centigrade. You want to keep them. You don't want them to be able to. You don't want to be able to boil water on your CPU. That would be a bad thing. And so, to protect themselves, they shut down or they run the fans louder. Keep it cool. You can buy, by the way, you can go to eBay for $5 and buy a laptop cooler. It's just a USB array of fans, several fans that go underneath the laptop. You put the laptop on it, you plug it into the USB port, and the fans run, and they actually do bring the temperature down a lot. I don't think that's the solution, because it's just going to give you more fans, not less, not fewer fans. 8888 Ask Leo, website's techguylabs.com. A few more minutes to go before we wrap this up. I will take some more questions. And don't forget that we put links to things we mentioned, and I hope you will put additional links on our website at techguylabs.com. So, you know, it's a valuable resource for anybody, like our caller, like Richard, so we can go there and see his question, but see also what you think. Maybe you've got a monitor you'd recommend. techguylabs.com. Greg in Tampa, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Leo, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I am fine. Got a question about NAS NAS devices. I have a Zytel and a Drivo, and I need another one. You talk a lot about Synology, and I'm looking for about a 5A device, and I really can't tell the difference online between Drivo and Synology.
Oh, good. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. So I'm going to first translate into English what you just said. He is.
I can do it in Spanish.
Can you? In English, what he's looking for, he has something called NAS storage, network attached storage, and this is before there was the cloud. This is what people used to store lots of data in their house. Maybe you have multiple computers, or you have a large music library, photos, or video library. A network attached storage device is a computer, absolutely, but it's a computer without a keyboard or a mouse or a monitor. You just put it on your network, maybe plug it into the router via an Ethernet cable, and it's visible to all the other computers on the network. You use your browser to change the settings and so forth, just like you do with your router. I love them. It's a great idea. Network-attached storage devices can be used, for instance, to back up multiple computers in a house. You can run backup software on them. They can then back that up to the cloud if you want. They can be used as media servers, iTunes or Windows media servers, so you can put all your music on a NAS and then play it from any device that supports those media servers, things like that. It's really handy. Drobo was just giant USB storage drives. And they added something called DroboShare that made it kind of a poor man's network-attached storage. They weren't really great in that field. They were really, initially anyway, designed to be big USB drives. Now, they've gotten a little more sophisticated, but I still have a little bit of a prejudice against them as network-attached storage. I love Synology, Synology. And one thing you should look at is the software. Remember, they're computers. So besides the fact you put multiple drives in there, and in many cases you can have so many hard drives that there's some redundancy. If one of them fails, you don't lose any data, things like that, using RAID and other technologies. Mm-hmm. That's pretty common in network-attached storage, and Drobo certainly does that. They use their own kind of proprietary RAID, but it works the same way. They're good at that. They're good at massive storage. But what you want to look at is what the software can do. For instance, I mentioned a few things. Can it be a media server if that's what you want? Can it back up from every computer if that's what you want? Can it back up the data it's backed up to the cloud now if that's what you want? Synology is very good. It manages that mostly with plugins that you can download. They're free from Synology. And I think they're really grade A in that regard. So that's why I like Synology. I think price-wise, it's probably comparable once you add the storage. I do like the idea of using a multiple drive array. Normally that's loud and hot, but the nice thing about network-attached storage is you can put it in a closet. You don't have to put it in the living room or the bedroom. You can put it away somewhere.
Yeah.
So, just based on my own experience, I like Drobo as a big USB drive. I like Synology for network-attached storage.
Mm. Well, there is a price difference, I think. Synology is somewhat more, but...
Is it really? Okay. Yeah, it used to be Drobo was very expensive, but they're more competitive now, I think.
Yeah.
They make the B800FS.
My favorite.
Which is, yeah, great name. That's the Drobo network-attached storage device. I haven't tried it, so I can't really. I shouldn't really say anything. I have tried Synology in many of its forms, and I do like it a lot. But Drobo is a good company. They do good stuff, and I think that they probably, since I last used DroboShare, which I was less than impressed with, I think they probably improved considerably.
Well, they own the transporter.
Yes, and I do use a transporter. I love my transporter.
Yeah, we do too. We have one in Colorado, one here in Florida.
Yeah, that's a great use for it.
Yeah,
because you back up to the transporter. It's kind of like your own personal cloud. You back up the transporter locally, but then you can have the transporters back each other up, and now you've got real redundancy. That's great.
Yeah. Hey, well, listen, thank you very much.
Yeah,
my pleasure. Take care for a little bit, and talk to you later.
All right, take care. Alex C. In the chat room says he's used 3 Drobos. They work great for me. They make network-only versions as well as USB and Thunderbolt. Yeah, I think Drobo's been around for a long time now. I would be shocked if they didn't have a credible NAS solution. 8888 Ask Leo. I think I have time for maybe 2 more. Let's start anyway with George in Encino. Hi, George.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Appreciate it. I'd like to get your recommendation for a portable computer that has a complete audio system in it, meaning input for the mic and out for the headphones. But the need for the computer is so it needs to handle a speech recognition software to display the audio on wearable, like a Google Glass or something else. Any idea on that?
No, I don't think that anybody makes that. I think it's a good idea. Usually people who make portable systems don't spend a lot of energy on the sound. Because they figure you'll use outboard stuff like your own speakers, your own mixer. And in most cases, that's preferable. But I guess you don't want to bring anything along with you. You want it just to all be in the laptop, right?
Well, yeah. Not a laptop. It needs to be like a portable. Like you can carry it on yourself, you know?
So it could be a little larger than a laptop. I think you stumped me. I don't think anybody makes those anymore. You know, I have a 25th anniversary Macintosh in the other room. Apple, because Steve Jobs was very interested in audio. Apple built into that Bose speakers. There's a Bose subwoofer. It's got a big, giant connector. In fact, most of the computer is in the subwoofer, believe it or not. So it makes the computer thin and it's beautiful. But that was a long time ago. That was like 15 years ago, and it's way out of date. I don't know of anybody, maybe the chat room knows of somebody, who's making a portable computing device that has kind of an audio recording system in it. Maybe there's something being made specially for recording studios. That might be the thing to do. Go to somewhere like Sweetwater or BWUSA.com and broadcast and see if they have something that's designed for portable recording or portable music. Afraid I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sorry to say. Let's see if Peggy has a question I can answer. Hi, Peggy. Got about half a minute left from Balboa.
Hi. Half a minute, I can give you one from LastPass. When LastPass makes makes the new passwords that you were talking about earlier, does it also change the password automatically?
No, you have to do that manually. But the newest LastPass has a button that makes it a little easier. It actually says, change my password. It'll bring you to this site and go to the part where you change the password. But you do have to manually do that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security and security now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today and Tech News Tonight. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.